You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why working women have taken a big hit from the pandemic economy. Now, this past weekend, over 3 million people traveled in airports, breaking the record for the most weekend travelers during the pandemic so far. With the vaccine beginning a slow rollout and at-home testing options in the works, it feels like we're starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel, but we still have a long way to go. Our next two guests are behind the Dear Pandemic Project, two of the researchers there. It's a social media, science-based media campaign designed to answer any and all questions related to COVID-19 for the general public. And you can ask one of those questions right now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the virus, about the vaccine rollout, the latest news from around the country and around the world? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Amanda, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on today.
And Malia Jones is a social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory and the UW-Madison Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. Malia, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, too.
Amanda, first off, take a look with us at the latest numbers here in Wisconsin and around the country. How are we doing?
Well, unlike the other times I've been on your program, we are on a decline right now in our average, number 7-day average of cases. So I think as of today, it's about 2,600. And about a month ago, it was nearly, 2.5 times that. So, that's encouraging. However, we also had a record number of deaths, and we know that deaths is a lagging indicator when it comes to COVID-19. So I don't think we're out of the woods yet. And if we think about the number of cases we're seeing on a daily basis right now compared to back in May and June, it's like 4 times what we were observing then. So it's good to be on a downward trajectory, but we're definitely, still in the middle of the winter season and the holidays coming up. So we need to be diligent still about what risk mitigation measures we're engaging in.
And Malia, we're hearing reports in the news over the last few days about a new potentially mutated version of the COVID-19 virus that, at least in the reports I'm seeing, not more dangerous if you get it, but more contagious. We're in early days on this development. What do we know about that?
Yeah, we have heard these reports about a new variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus that's circulating pretty widely in the UK and some other parts of Europe. And there's been major splashy headlines about it, but you pretty much summed up what we know so far about this. It doesn't appear to be an apocalyptic scenario. There's no really good reason to think so far that the vaccines that we have developed won't work for this variant. And both Pfizer and Moderna are testing that and should be able to release some information to us about it next week. So it's a sort of watch and see. Everyone's following it very closely, but I don't think it's time to panic about this.
All right. Some pieces of good news, and we'll get to some more as with vaccine rollouts. But Amanda, we've been at this for a while now. We've talked some in the past about the risk of pandemic fatigue, people who maybe have been doing the right thing, wearing the masks, distancing, so on, taking chances that they didn't used to. Do we know if that's happening?
I think our downward case trends maybe are an indication that, when people saw our spiking cases at the state level, that they maybe made alternative decisions about, the Thanksgiving holiday, for example. Our recommendation for getting together with people for the holiday was to quarantine if you could for the 2 weeks prior to gathering. And if you couldn't do that, to try to gather outdoors to keep your group of people small, not share food, and kind of choose alternatives that allow for space, wearing masks as much as possible, increased ventilation, reduced, number of people, and reduced time. And I think even though we are feeling the, fatigue, we are approaching a second holiday where we really want to be with our family members, trying to apply those criteria and thinking about ways to reduce risk this holiday it's probably more important than ever because we do have a light at the end of the tunnel right now with vaccines being started to roll out. You know, so we may make that decision to forgo gathering this December for holidays so that we can maximize who can be around next December to gather for that purpose.
We've got two Wisconsin epidemiologists with us right now looking at the latest COVID-19 news. Amanda Simonek from UW-Milwaukee, Malia Jones from UW-Madison. They are both involved in the Dear Pandemic Project. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Malia, Amanda just mentioned the vaccines. They're rolling out. Healthcare workers so far, more waves of them coming. What are you looking at when it comes to how, where, and when vaccines are delivered?
I am really in a very hopeful place. I mean, it's been a long year, but to be ending it on a note where we actually have two what look like very effective and very safe vaccines that have reached the market under emergency use authorization and are actually rolling out. And we're starting to get the people who have been putting their lives on the line, our healthcare providers, vaccinated is just, it's great news. It really does feel like the light at the end of the tunnel. The supply on these vaccines, you know, these manufacturers have been making doses of the vaccines all along, just kind of hoping that they would work out. And knowing that if the vaccines failed or they didn't get approved because of safety concerns, they'd have to just throw them all away. But they were approved. They're very effective. And the clinical trial data showed no reason for major safety concerns. And so that's why we have several, almost 200,000 doses across these two vaccines that are already allocated to the state of Wisconsin. Of course, that's not nearly enough to cover everyone in the state, and it's going to take some time before the vaccines become available to the general public. But I'm just tremendously relieved that our healthcare providers are starting to get their vaccines. And every time I see one of these pictures of someone I know who works in healthcare getting theirs, I'm really delighted by it. And we will start to see people who live in long-term care facilities getting vaccinated next week, I understand.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us in Green Bay. Tom, hello.
Hello. Was curious about the ratios nationwide to Wisconsin in terms of infections to death. And I believe nationwide there was something in the neighborhood of 300,000 deaths, whereas infections, I thought, were in the 20 or 30 million range. And how does Wisconsin compare?
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. And that ratio, Amanda, let's throw this to you. It's been a moving target because we knew early we probably had a lot of people catching COVID-19, not getting tested at any point. The numbers have probably gotten more realistic as we've moved along. How do we compare in Wisconsin to the rest of the nation?
Well, certainly a month ago, we were ranking in the top in terms of our case burden. And I think we have dropped down that list, luckily, now. In terms of, I'm not exactly sure what the caller is asking.
Well, I think he's looking for deaths per cases as a ratio.
I don't know that offhand. I don't know. Malia, do you know?
You know, I haven't looked at it recently, but there was a report that came out maybe a couple of months ago now, maybe 2 months ago, that said that suggested that Wisconsin was actually performing relatively well in terms of the number of cases versus the number of deaths. But as you alluded to, Rob, that's very dependent on who gets tested, because that, you know, it's a ratio. So if we want to look at a comparison, we would want to know whether we have captured all the likely cases. And so I think it's a little hard to directly compare. The big uptick in deaths that we're seeing right now is clearly related to the age of people who have gotten sick over the last couple of months. And as Amanda mentioned, that lagged indicator of the burden of disease, that the number of deaths has really shown us that this is not something to be trifled with over the last 2 weeks.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Diane now in Waukesha. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Diane?
I wanted to bring up the fact that I have a daughter who is a recent graduate of college, and she's an RN at UW Health. And because she will be getting the she is available to get the vaccine, but she's a young woman who hasn't had any children yet. And so we're concerned about long-term effects with respect to that, birth defects and or fertility, all those kinds of issues. So,
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know, I'll throw this to Malia, but hand it off if you want. Do we know anything about women who are currently pregnant getting the vaccine or women who may someday be pregnant getting the vaccine now?
Yeah, there is this rumor flying around about the possibility that this vaccine could cause fertility issues. And I want to emphasize that there is no factual basis for this rumor at all. The vaccines were not trialed in pregnant women. They were certainly trialed in women across all ages. And some of those women happened to get pregnant during the trial. There were no reasons to think that the vaccine had any negative effect on those pregnancies. And professional organization that represents OBGYNs came out very strongly saying that pregnant women who are in high risk jobs, such as nursing, should have the option to get the vaccine if they want it. And it was approved by the FDA. It was recommended by the FDA and the CDC for administering in pregnant women if they want to. So there was some extensive discussion of this, whether there was possibility of birth defects and in pregnant women. And the consensus amongst the scientists in the independent panel for the FDA and the CDC was that there's really no plausible biological mechanism by which that could happen. These vaccines are not thought to cross the placental barrier. They don't contain any kind of virus at all. They're not made with a virus, and they really rely on the normal immune functions of the human body in order to produce immunity. So I am not worried. And I think that time will tell that there is not a reason to suspect that there, you know, anything could go wrong with birth defects or fertility down the line either.
And Rob, I'll add, you know, we have covered this on our Dear Pandemic social media campaign. We posted on this very topic, as well as sort of what we can expect in terms of following the safety and, you know, the reporting of any adverse events moving forward. So those topics, people can go to dearpandemic.org and search for those posts and see a comprehensive overview of answers to those types of questions.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to two of the editors of the Dear Pandemic Project. Malia Jones is a social epidemiologist at UW-Madison. Amanda Simonek, associate professor of epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee. Still time for your question for our guests. You can email ideas@WPR.org or call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your COVID-19 related questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with our two Dear Pandemic guests, Amanda Simonek, associate professor of epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee, and Malia Jones, social epidemiologist at UW-Madison. You can join in with your COVID-related questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is on your mind right now? And Amanda, when I talk to Dear Pandemic people, I like to ask what you are being asked. What kind of questions are you hearing a lot lately?
Well, I think with the, you know, past month, almost every week we have new vaccine news. We've been getting a lot of questions about the vaccine, both, you know, how it was developed, how safety monitoring is going to work, and, why it was approved, and, you know, lots of reasons and questions related to that. So, for sure, that's been a dominant theme lately.
And Malia, I'm seeing news about faster test kits, maybe at-home test kits being available to us before too long. What are we seeing there?
That's right. The state of Wisconsin just, I think it was today, announced that they are going to be making available test kits by mail. And this is a PCR-based test kit that uses saliva that you self-collect in a kit at home and then mail in to get a COVID test. And those are going to be available to everyone in the state of Wisconsin who requests one. So you can get info about that at the Department of Health Services website if you want to request a test kit. I think it's maybe helpful for some of those parts of Wisconsin that are more rural and people don't have really ready access to testing, or perhaps it would take a really long drive to get to a test site. So I think that's going to be a helpful addition, one more tool in our toolbox to continue fighting this pandemic.
We had a question. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I agree. I think the more options we have for testing, the better. And, you know, if you are home and you're sick, this is, you know, potentially a way to not have to go out of the house when you're not feeling well to go get tested as well.
We had a question for Jill in Madison who asked, why are the death rates higher when we've seen the case numbers going down? And Amanda, that gets into a little bit of what we talked about earlier, the lagging indicator. Today's test results are unfortunately the people who might be dying in a couple few weeks.
Yes, unfortunately, there is this lag. You know, it can take about an average of 5 days after being exposed for someone to develop symptoms, and then maybe another 5 or 6 days before they would have severe enough symptoms to need to be hospitalized. Then you can imagine some time in the hospital before they would need to go into ICU care, for instance. And so there is about, you know, we expect almost a 4 to 6 week lag between when you have a spike in cases or surge in cases and when you start to see, you know, the related deaths. And so the fact that we have had increasing deaths, you know, we may not be completely out of the woods yet in terms of the deaths that we're going to observe from our previous surge here in Wisconsin.
I'd say we're even right in the middle of the deaths that we're, you know, we could have predicted the deaths that we're seeing today based on the numbers that we were seeing 4 to 6 weeks ago. And so Amanda, the good news here is here that we're trending back down. And so in another few weeks, we will expect to see deaths trending back down again.
And I hate to step on good news. It looks good in Wisconsin, the things arcing down in terms of cases in the right direction. When I look nationwide, Amanda, not great. Things have been spiraling upwards in cases, and then following that again, deaths going up. How much does that worry you about, you know, things might bounce back here to Wisconsin if they're going up elsewhere in the country?
Well, I mean, I think in Wisconsin and anywhere where there's still susceptible individuals, this infection, you know, has the potential to spread in the population. And that isn't going to change until, you know, we reach a level of herd immunity, ideally through vaccination. And so it is going to require individuals to still, you know, maintain vigilance about space and masking and staying out of poorly ventilated spaces, you know, for a while. So I think we're on a good downward trend now. We don't want to sort of let up or let our guard down because, you know, I think we could experience another surge if that happens.
Talking to two experts with the Dear Pandemic Web Project, Amanda Simonek and Malia Jones, both epidemiologists in the UW system. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Green Bay. Bill, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Bill?
Oh, I have the most important question that you're going to have today. I'm a senior. I'm 72 years old. I've had two heart attacks, open heart surgery, and I have an aneurysm. I've made about at least 10 phone calls. I'd like to know, being at risk, I have an aneurysm. My doctor doesn't know. The hospital doesn't know. I think it's because of geography. We're in Green Bay, not in Phoenix. My cousin knows that he's going to get his vaccination next week. And unfortunately, we're in Wisconsin. My doctor doesn't know. My hospital doesn't know. Nobody knows how the seniors at risk, when they're going to get it, and how they're going to get it, and where they're going to get it.
Bill, thanks for the call. Does either of you want to tackle that? How somebody in a high-risk group like Bill knows when they can get the vaccine?
Yeah, I would be happy to tackle that, Bill. It's a really important question. And the answer is going to be partially unsatisfying. So just this past weekend on Sunday, the CDC panel that makes recommendations about priority groups, you know, we can't vaccinate everybody. We only have so many doses, so we've got to prioritize. The CDC panel that makes those recommendations met and decided that the next priority group, it's called phase 1B, they're recommending be people who are age 75 years and up, as well as some frontline healthcare, some essential frontline workers. And we are waiting for Wisconsin's Department of Health Services to make a decision about whether they're going to adopt those recommendations as given or make some modifications to them in terms of who's going to be next up to be eligible for the vaccine. Now, group 1C, the next group after 1B, the CDC recommended would be people who are age 65 and up and anyone age 16 and up with a serious underlying risk factor. My guess, Bill, is that you're going to be in one of these next two groups and that you can watch the Department of Health Services website for info about how exactly to receive that vaccine. We have a couple of the pharmacy chains in Wisconsin that are primed to distribute the vaccines. It's a huge logistical operation. And I think that we can all, I know everyone is really impatient to get their vaccines, but we're going to have a little grace and wait for Department of Health Services and then the logistical operations to get sorted out here.
Bill, thanks for calling in. I hope you get good news soon. And that's all the time we have. Amanda, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
And Malia, thanks for being with us again.
Yep, thank you.
We've been talking to Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee, and Malia Jones, Social Epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Lab and the UW-Madison Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. They're both editors of Dear Pandemic on social media. Search for Dear Pandemic for lots of other answers to COVID-19 questions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about 2020's National Geographic Explorer of the Year.
A Wisconsinite has been named the Rolex National Geographic 2020 Explorer of the Year. Corey Jaskolski has worked on every continent in nearly 50 countries. Among his many accomplishments, he's used cameras and artificial intelligence software, or AI, to create virtual reality maps of ancient ruins, protect endangered species, and deter poachers in his work with National Geographic.
We can use technology to be the eyes where we can't always be present. So a good example of it is if we have a camera trap, a traditional like trail camera that people use up here in the woods to see how many deer are going by their property. If we have a camera like that sitting out on a tree in Africa, we can actually have an AI system look at those images, understand what's in those images, and send us alerts when something specific happens. For example, if we're looking for lions or poachers or elephants. Whereas if we had four or five people that were going out looking for an endangered species, you know, we could only do what we could keep four people awake for through each and every night. But we can put hundreds of cameras out. It's like the Terminator. They don't eat, they don't sleep, they just do their AI job.
Jaskolski says growing up in the Milwaukee area helped him develop his love for exploration.
So when I was a kid, we didn't travel as kids, never had been out of the country, you know, maybe made it out of the state once or twice. But the Milwaukee Public Museum to me was this place where I could be an explorer, where I could see these animals that I, you know, only saw in books sort of come to life in front of me. And it gave me this, opportunity to think, well, maybe a little kid that wants to see the world and wants to be an explorer and wants to travel to all the continents, maybe it's actually possible. And so, you know, my mom took us there a lot as kids, in part just to get the screaming kids out of the house, I think, but also in part to show us a broader view of the world and guide us towards some of the important things, shared cultural and natural things around us.
Dr. Ellen Senske is the president and CEO of Milwaukee Public Museum. She says Jaskolski's life and work reinforce the museum's role in the community.
What it does is it just shows you how much these kinds of institutions in these communities, how they truly do impact people. And he's not the only one who's told us the way the exhibits take you on those adventures. So that really gives you a sense of there is something more than what's in my backyard.
And now, Jaskolski's been named Nat Geo's 2020 Explorer of the Year.
It's a huge honor. It's a culmination of, you know, an entire career worth of work. When you're out there doing this stuff, you don't always think that what you're doing is necessarily the most cutting edge, most impactful. You're kind of just in the work. You're kind of, you know, deep in the weeds, 3D scanning a Sumatran rhino or diving on a submarine on Titanic, and you don't really stop to think about the impact that the work has. So winning the award was a chance to just step back and take a deep breath and realize all the things I've been able to do and been fortunate enough to be able to contribute to. And, you know, it's fuel for what comes next. It's definitely inspired me to keep going.
And here's Dr. Senske.
He's just somebody that you're drawn to because he's so quiet and unassuming, but he's done so much with his life. So, you know, how could you not name him, you know, Explorer of the Year?
Jaskolski's not done exploring, but he is looking forward to reflecting on his adventures, eventually.
You know, from 12,500 feet deep on the wreck of Titanic to, you know, 26,000 feet helicoptering with laser scanners over Everest. I think we've covered a lot of land and a lot of ground and a lot of water and have some pretty good stories to tell from each of those expeditions, as you might imagine.
Corey Jaskolski, congratulations on the big award.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Corey Jaskolski is a Wisconsin native and the Rolex National Geographic 2020 Explorer of the Year. And Dr. Ellen Senske is president and CEO of Milwaukee Public Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Goldberg.
Now, more women than men are enrolled in college, medical schools, and law schools, and earlier this year, the number of women in the workforce briefly eclipsed the number of men. But a majority of the 1.1 million people who left their jobs in September were women, and recent data suggests some have opted out altogether with the pandemic, making it harder to balance work and caregiving. Experts are worried this will reverse some of the strides women have made toward gender equality in the workforce. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you leave the workforce for a while anyway to care for children or other adults during the pandemic? Why was it the best move for your family? How has this all affected the division of labor in your household? Has it changed your relationship? Email ideas@WPR.org or call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Margaret Kerr is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison and a specialist at UW Extension. Margaret, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, there are a lot of statistics out there suggesting that women have in many different ways taken the brunt of the pandemic economic impact. What kind of things are you looking at for what's driving that?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of what I've been looking at is, you know, what are the impacts of that? And just finding that parents, women, mothers are more impacted, you know, mentally and psychologically. They're feeling more burnt out as parents. They're reporting more distress. They're reporting more anxiety than men are right now.
And we've seen as more and more women are in the workforce and those numbers start to even out, what's been happening at home when it comes to division of labor in, you know, a couple, a heterosexual couple, man and a woman at home? How have they been dividing up the chores and the child rearing and things like that pre-pandemic? Because I'm guessing that feeds into what we're seeing now.
Absolutely. So pre-pandemic things had come a long way, and men were doing more childcare and home responsibilities than, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but women were still doing more. Women were still spending a couple hours more a day on childcare and household responsibilities even before the pandemic started.
So here we are, pandemic, kids in many cases not going into school, staying at home, learning hopefully at home. How has that division of labor played out since the pandemic, from what we know? Because this is research-wise still early days in some ways.
Yeah, so in the study I talked about when I was here a couple months ago, we did look at this a little bit, and this is not like a nationally representative data, but we found that women in our study, 76% said they did more childcare than their partners, while only 28% of men did that. So women are taking on significantly more childcare responsibilities during the time when kids are home and not at school or at childcare.
And that, I assume, is leading to difficulties. The stress you mentioned earlier, trying to balance the work and the additional responsibilities at home.
Yeah, so women are, I mean, there's two things that are happening. Women are not able to juggle at all, and so they are leaving the workforce because it's just, you know, unfortunately, there are still gender pay gaps also, and so often men are still making more money, and so women are more likely to be the one that leaves the workforce to take care of children. Or they're still working, and they're doing a greater share of childcare, but then trying to make up work, you know, at night when the kids are sleeping, or early in the morning, or, you know, trying to really balance both of those, and we're seeing the impacts of that as well.
Now, that first thing you mentioned sounds like it might be a self-sustaining cycle. If the woman is making less and thus is the one who takes time off work, that means they're missing that time of resume building, possible raises, things like that. So if and when they come back to the workforce, the difference, that disparity might even go up.
Absolutely. And I am not an economist, but a lot of people and researchers are saying that they're expecting this gender difference, that we've maybe reversed a lot of the progress we've made, and that this is going to go on for, you know, potentially decades.
We're talking to Margaret Kerr, assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison and specialist at UW-Extension, talking about how women are bearing the brunt in many ways of the pandemic economic downturn, financially and in terms of things like stress, their health. And they're taking on more of the homework, sometimes leaving the workforce temporarily to do that. Margaret, we've talked a little bit about the economic impact. Get a little more into, you mentioned the study you had done looking at women having to do more. How is that affecting things like stress levels and maybe even health?
Yeah, there's a lot of research coming out now that it's been 9 months or whatever it's been since this all started. And we are seeing that women are reporting higher levels of distress, higher levels of mental health issues, higher levels of burnout as parents. And, you know, a lot of us don't have, we can't make those causal assumptions, but it likely is related to just the fact that women are trying to juggle more.
Do you think we're learning lessons? Are there things that we're maybe doing better than we did early days, now that we're, 9 months into the serious impact of this pandemic?
That's a tough question. I think maybe we're learning lessons, but it's just a question of, you know, are we going to do anything about it? And I think, you know, there are things that we can all tell parents and moms to do at home, you know, like, yo, you need to take care of yourself and things like that. But ultimately, there needs to be sort of like structural or societal changes that help support women. And one of those things was childcare, and losing of that for a lot of people, it just had huge implications. And I like to think that this really shed a light on that. But whether or not anything is going to be different going forward is hard to say.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Margaret Kerr is with us from UW-Madison, assistant professor there of human development and family studies. We're talking about how the pandemic has affected men and women differently and how it's affected families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has your family been dealing with the impact of the pandemic and maybe schools being closed? Have one or another partner changed a work schedule, dropped out of work altogether, maybe to supervise kids learning at home? who is taking on more of the chores now, the tasks that have fallen to one partner or another in the past. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we continue our conversation about the impact of the pandemic on working women at work and at home. Margaret Kerr is with us, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. Her work focuses on examining emotional experiences in the context of parenthood. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to share what is happening in your household, in your family. Is one partner or another having to spend a lot more time at home, maybe working with kids who are home from school, learning at home? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Margaret, you mentioned a lot of advice is out there, like here's how you, the individual mom, say, can cope with this situation. And you mentioned that there you'd like to see more structural solutions. Do you have thoughts on what that could look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see a good examples in other countries that have, you know, universal preschool and paid childcare and things. And maybe the pandemic, you know, would still disrupt some of those things, but there are supports in place for families so that, you know, it doesn't all fall on women to take care of the children.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Auroraville. Laura, hi.
Hi, I am calling. I actually have a University of Wisconsin-Madison college student who came home to do her studies online because Madison told them to go home. And I can't tell you how stressed she is trying to keep up her grades in order to get accepted into her college, and to do it in a distance learning in a rural community in Wisconsin where internet, every time she logs into a test for Madison, it says, quote unquote, you are bad, which means her internet connection is bad. So she's under this stress of just constantly crying. So in the end, I ended up quitting my teaching job because I worked so many hours as a teacher, and I took a part-time job instead to support my 21-year-old because of the stress that she's undergoing. And I just really think universities need to understand the stress of these students better too.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. That's interesting for a college student or a K through 12 student, that stressful situation, and a lot of people in Laura's position helping out, trying to be IT managers, among other things. Margaret, can you talk about the stress that could put on the mom there?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And what we're seeing in my data and in other data is that, you know, parents, mothers especially, are reporting high levels of stress associated with facilitating distance learning. And I think that, you know, she brought up a great idea, which is the rural piece of it is really add some extra challenges. And I think, you know, again, there's an example of some places where we could make some improvements in helping rural families access better internet quality.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Laura, good luck to your daughter, by the way, in navigating that. Sounds like a big challenge, definitely. Margaret, are there things institutions could be doing, like the university in that case, or a school, or employers can be doing to, I don't know, just cut some slack to people who are going through this difficult time right now?
Absolutely. And I think that some places are doing that, and it just varies a lot by institution. And that, you know, it would be helpful to have some larger, like, government or society guidance on it to help people stay more on the same page. But, you know, employers, just flexibility, I think most importantly for both men and women. I think that women are more likely to flex their schedules, and that is, again, causing some of these other problems, like making them less likely to get a promotion and things like that, whereas men are less likely to ask for that type of flexibility in their work schedules. And so some of those things could really make a difference.
Thanks again for that call. And Margaret, I wanted to ask, last time we talked about, you know, the impact this has on mental health, and we've talked about that a little today. You also, in your research that we talked about, found a lot of people reporting a lot of gratitude and some other positive emotions. What kind of positive things have we heard from people?
Yeah, I think those things are definitely, you know, can happen at the same time, I guess I'll say. So I think we are seeing parents are feeling some gratitude and some positive coping skills and things in their finding ways that they're growing and changing and strengthening relationships with their partners and their children. But, you know, I think that that can come along with a lot of struggles. And I think that that's true for families that maybe aren't not being able to pay their bills or things like that, those struggles that are really hard to get over.
And then with those struggles, toward the bigger picture solution types of things, are you concerned that there's not enough access to mental health help in general, and particularly in a time like this, to help people get through?
Yeah, I think some places have made teletherapy free during this time. Some insurance companies have, which I think has been a huge help, but I think there's still a lot of problems with accessing it, availability, knowing how to access it, and the stigma that's associated with accessing mental health care.
I wanted to ask, we talked, Margaret, about your research and surveys of people earlier this year. What kind of things are you looking to learn now as we head into 2021 and hopefully recovering from this pandemic in the not too distant future?
Yeah, so I actually just recently launched a follow-up survey for the same parents that completed the survey back in April. And what I'm hoping to look at is what are the things that predict better and worse outcomes for families? So are there factors like losing your job, like the, you know, more extreme stress and mental health impacts that are predicting more stress later in their children or more stress later in themselves? And so that's some of the things I'm hoping to gain so that we can learn, you know, how to support people going forward. So if something like this happens again, we can act faster and give parents the supports that they need to be able to keep a job, basically.
And how about, what are you looking at when it comes to, okay, the kids at some point are back in school and life is normal? I'll throw quotes around that again. And how people make the adjustment back to the new normal?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think you brought that up earlier and it's a really good point, which is that unfortunately, you know, women who left the workforce as a result of all this may struggle to get back into the workforce. And so I think those are the types of things that we're going to be looking at going forward. And people that, you know, I think going back to new normal is not going to be as easy as it sounds. And I think we're going to just see people still struggling.
Margaret, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Margaret Kerr is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison and a specialist at UW-Extension. We talked to her about how the pandemic's economic fallout has affected women at the workplace and in the home.